Resistance to systems of hate and injustice has taken some interesting public forms in recent months, has it not? Cities and towns all over the country saw nonviolent demonstrations with the women's marches last January. In places like Standing Rock, North Dakota, and St. Louis, Missouri, protesters have used nonviolent means to draw attention to injustice by disrupting the status quo. In many cases, protesters have used their bodies to block access to things like roads, bridges, and bodies of water. More recently, we've seen Colin Kaepernick inspire thousands of players from professional football all the way down to the Pinole Valley High School football team, who took a knee in protest of police brutality at their homecoming game last week. And alongside these nonviolent forms of protest, the anti-fascist movement known as Antifa has organized armed demonstrations against white supremacy. All of these demonstrations, and many others like them, are much like the dog that would not stop barking in this morning's story for all ages. It takes a lot of energy and persistence to draw attention to problems that people don't want to see. It's even harder if those people are like our king and have never had to come face to face with the breadth and depth of the problem before at all. And it's no surprise that so many people in our world have focused more on how to force the dog to stop barking rather than address the reasons she began barking in the first place. Even more fascinating than the resistance itself are the efforts being made to undermine and delegitimize it. Years ago, my congregation made hot food for the Occupy protesters in Boston. While taking the food to the protesters, I remember people shouting at me while I'm wearing a collar, "Get a job!" Like I don't have a job? Like, okay. And I'm going to run you over and you'll deserve it. That was the one I really remember. Protesters in St. Louis and other places who intentionally blocked access to roads and bridges as a means of drawing more attention to their cause have been portrayed as irresponsible, immoral, and even evil for disrupting business as usual. And just last week, Vice President Mike Pence spent our tax dollars to go to an NFL football game specifically for the purpose of walking out when the players took a knee during the national anthem. Originally undertaken in order to draw attention to police brutality, this protest is now being framed by many as a public display of disrespect to the flag, thus undermining the barking of the dog. And last but not least, members of Antifa are being accused of having no moral integrity, of being just as bad as the fascists they abhor, because they are willing to meet violence with violence as part of their resistance. Our faith, Unitarian Universalism, has a long tradition of involvement in socially and politically controversial issues, a long history of struggling to discern whether we should be fixing or fighting the system. And as our readings this morning hint at, our forebears didn't always agree, either about the issues themselves or about the right way to resist injustice together. Before John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, most Unitarians were abolitionists, but they overwhelmingly preferred a gradual ending to slavery. These were folks who wanted to fix the system. The Revolutionary War had just ended 7 decades before the raid, which means Americans in the 1850s would have grown up hearing just as many stories about the War of Independence as many of us have grown up hearing firsthand accounts of the Second World War. So it doesn't really surprise me that there were so many people who wanted to avoid the possibility of war at all costs. But other people viewed things differently. Rather than feeling it important to avoid war at all costs, the Reverend Theodore Parker's writings suggest he felt it most important to liberate African Americans from the national sin of slavery at all costs. Parker preached passionately against the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which required non-slave states to aid in the capture and return of former slaves who had fled within their borders. It is said that he kept a gun behind his pulpit in order to protect former slaves in his congregation. And we know of at least one former slave to whom he gave sanctuary in his own home. Though the issues we face today are different, it's telling that many of the arguments about tactics then and now are the same. Many of us here today, and many you use in general, I think, favor trying to fix the system by pursuing gradual, progressive change through changing hearts and minds and laws. Some may feel that this is the most likely way to be effective in effecting change. Others of us think trying to fix a system so broken is a waste of time, and believe in fighting the system and working for justice regardless of popular opinion about our goals or means. For most of my life, I considered myself a progressive and a dedicated pacifist. I engaged in nonviolent demonstrations as a teenager and later as a young adult when then President Bush led many of my classmates to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I believed wholeheartedly in the moral superiority of nonviolence and would probably have been willing to give up my life for that ideal. And then I had my first child. And suddenly, all of my systematically worked out theology and ideals were challenged by the reality of this beautiful baby I had been given to care and love. I knew the night my first child was born that I would do anything and everything to keep him safe. And ever since that night, I've been wrestling with my faith, because regardless of what I've believed intellectually most of my life about the rightness of never using violence for any reason, I also know in my bones, in a primal way, that there is nothing more right in this world than protecting my children from danger. In our religious tradition, we are challenged to examine our faith, to carefully evaluate our ideals, our beliefs. And it seems I'm being challenged to re-examine my personal stance on the use of force, since my systematic and my embodied theologies don't match up right now. And I think many Americans are likewise feeling challenged to re-examine some of the assumptions we may have held about whether it's worth it to try to fix our system, which is so broken, or whether we should prepare to fight the system so we can build one that works for people who aren't wealthy, white, heterosexual, cisgender men. Progressive, peaceful change that builds momentum and brings people along and brings people together makes an awful lot of sense intellectually. It is the ideal. But when my friend sends her African-American teenager out with his friends at night and worries about what might happen to him at the hands of her community's police officers, progressive change seems like a cruel liberal joke. The crux of the philosophical argument for nonviolence, as I understand it, is that the use of violence can never be justified, even if it is in the service of justice and liberation. In other words, it's morally bunk to use violence to achieve a nonviolent goal. It is hypocritical. And yet, as Brazilian theorist Paulo Freire argued, we must also ask ourselves if the brutal reality of life faced by millions of people in our country and our world can be justified, even if it would require violence to end that oppression. In his seminal work, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, Freire writes, "With the establishment of a relationship of oppression, violence has already begun. Never in history has violence been initiated by the oppressed. How could they be the initiators if they themselves are the result of violence? There would be no oppressed had there been no prior situation of violence to establish their subjugation." I've heard and read many people measure today's justice work against the example of the civil rights movement. Any protest in which violence occurs, no matter the circumstances or the initiator, is quickly criticized. But the realities that we face today, I believe, are starkly different than what the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. faced in the 50s and 60s. The people who voted for and then reinforced Jim Crow thought of themselves as morally right. And that meant that putting those people in situations where they used violence to prevent people of color from doing simple things like drinking from water fountains revealed to them their own moral failure. That is why nonviolence can be successful. But the problem in Germany in the 1930s and here in America today is that Nazis and violent fascist white supremacists don't care about moral integrity. There is no way to use their own actions to reveal their moral failure to them, because there is no way to shame them into changing their ways, because in many cases it seems that they have no shame. Now, I don't question the moral strength of the foundation of nonviolence or how effectively it has been used in the past. I also believe it can and will be effective in specific contexts again. But I do question the way I see nonviolence philosophy being used to try and delegitimize an awful lot of the dogs I hear barking in this country today, warning us of the injustice taking deeper and deeper root among us. Because if oppressed people feel they can be most effective at changing things and keeping their kids safe by using some sort of force, the same force I know in my bones I would use to protect my own babies, I don't think any of us who are privileged not to face the same dangers they do are in any position to judge the moral integrity of their resistance tactics. Because it's easy to forget that the institution of slavery was brought to an end with a war, not through slow, gradual, progressive change. The threat posed by the Nazis was ultimately defeated with a war, not with pacifism. And the ongoing fight for LGBTQ liberation has not always been defined by peaceful pride parades. It has included the markedly unpeaceful Compton's Cafeteria riots in San Francisco and the Stonewall riots in New York City. In my 8 years in ministry, I've heard from countless people concerned that focusing on justice work might take away from the church's pastoral care and support work. And I have to confess that this actually is not a distinction that I understand. Slavery was not some outside issue for Unitarians to fight just for the sake of other people. It was a real and present threat for Unitarians themselves, a personal and pastoral issue for Frederick Douglass and other former slaves who occasionally and regularly worshiped at All Souls Church Unitarian in Washington, D.C. Racism is not some outside issue for this congregation. It is an oppression faced and lived with and struggled against every single day by members of our own families, of our neighborhoods, of this church, and as such is a pastoral issue. Nor is immigration some separate issue for us to support. It is a pastoral issue because families here in our church, in our wider communities, are suffering as their loved ones and members of their neighborhoods and schools are being deported or live in fear of being deported. These are pastoral issues, not just justice issues. Deciding how best to resist injustice and oppression was not simple or straightforward in the 1850s, nor is it today. As our democratic institutions and their protections begin to crumble, there are no easy answers, and we may find ourselves having to prioritize our moral commitments as new realities challenge some of our long-held opinions. Because as Audre Lorde wrote, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. Ultimately, I think we need to acknowledge the extent to which the cause of justice has benefited from the work and sacrifice of radicals who began movements like the abolition of slavery, LGBTQ liberation, feminism, and Black Lives Matter. The time in which we live and the realities we are facing heading into 2018 challenge us to examine not just our positions on issues, but how our philosophies, our ethics, our theologies either reinforce or challenge the unjust status quo. And until and unless we decenter privileged voices and begin to center the voices of the people for whom our system is unjust and deadly, I fear our efforts to fix or fight the system will fail. Our work towards justice is pastoral work, because the many forms of oppression are interwoven into our congregation, our schools, our communities, our lives, our church. May this church be a space where we can examine and re-examine our faith, our belief, our philosophies and ethics and theologies. May we be granted the humility to balance what sounds right intellectually with what our bones tell us is needed in the all too often brutal reality of our world. And may we find the courage to live out the commitments towards which we are compelled, giving all that we can for the sake of our neighbors, for the sake of justice, for the sake of our children, and the world that they will inhabit when all of us are gone. Amen.